Our cat, Sky, darted out behind the car. And before either of us knew what had happened, Sky was struck and limped into the bushes that lined the flower bed in front of our home. As I carefully peeled back the branches, I found her lying there bleeding and struggling to breathe. Without a single word, Shonda rushed into the house and quickly grabbed a towel so that I could lift Sky, careful not to hurt her already bruised and bloodied body. I gently scooped her up, laid her in the passenger side seat. The vet's office was only about a 5-minute drive away. Upon arriving at the clinic, I picked Sky up again, cradling her broken body against mine as though I were holding one of my children. Sky had made the move from California to Illinois in 2020, in 2000, and then back to California in 2006. I had raised Sky from birth. I walked up to the receptionist counter to check her in. It wasn't long before we were ushered into an exam room. I sat down holding Sky on my lap, but it didn't take very long before she was struggling to jump down to the floor. So I put her on the floor. She limped into a corner, and she laid there, heaving with every breath. Her tiny body was broken. And although I had managed to work up this alternative narrative in my mind where the vet came in, examined Sky, and said something pithy like, "We'll have her as good as new in no time," I knew no such words would be spoken that day. The fact of the matter was that this was it. This was the last day I'd say goodbye to the cat I had raised from the first day of her life. And it killed me to know that this day had finally arrived. And worse, that it felt like it had arrived prematurely and that I had to bear witness to the whole grotesque unfolding of it. The vet, with such tenderness and compassion, gave me the options. Actually, she gave me the option, which didn't feel much like an option at all. She told me she would leave us so that I could have some time to say goodbye. And, you know, I know and you know that life is full of goodbyes, but most of us, if we're lucky, go through this life hopefully ever having to say only a handful of final goodbyes. But this was one of those goodbyes. Final. After the vet closed the door behind me, I picked Sky up one final time. There's that word again. Softly pressed her against my chest. I didn't know if she knew that this was it for her, her final goodbye. I looked at her at once with love and anger. After all, watching her suffer had absolutely undone me. Driving away from my house with my wife and my children crying in the rearview mirror had undone me. Hearing the vet's instructions on how my cat would just fall asleep had undone me. Why wasn't there someone else at this point who could take it from here? And so I looked at Sky and I just kept repeating, "You stupid, stupid cat." This crazy cat, who'd been my constant companion for the last 9 years of my life, had gone and made me fall in love with her, which was impossible because I don't even like cats. Cats are what you get when dogs aren't available. But there I was, contrary to my profound dislike for cats, loving this one, shedding copious amounts of tears and snot over a cat who was there when I first cooked spaghetti for what would then eventually become my wife, Shonda, and when I brought my first two children home from the hospital, and who was supposed to be at home waiting there to welcome my last child, Sam, in just a matter of months. I had planned a lot of things that moving day, but having my cat put to sleep was not on the agenda. I remember an old commercial, maybe you remember this commercial too, I think it was maybe Allstate, and it said something along the lines of, "Life comes at you fast." Is that Allstate? You remember this commercial? Well, that's only partly true, that life comes at you fast. It feels rather like an incomplete statement, because not only does life come at you fast, it also rather frequently, I might add, punches you in the face then knocks you to the ground. Are you in good hands? Apparently not. Otherwise, I wouldn't be lying on the floor, curled up like an armadillo, weeping and shaking in the vet's office. Funny thing you learn when life comes at you fast and sucker punches you is this. While I was backing out of the driveway with my dying cat lying beside me in the passenger seat, I saw my neighbor's kid riding his bike. He actually waved at me. He didn't know what was happening. And before even thinking about the incongruity of his smiling face and my present predicament and the boy's not a care in the world, I'm good riding my bike because I'm five and I don't yet know how fast life can come at you attitude, I lifted my hand off of Sky's chest and I just waved back. Jesus tells his disciples to take up their cross and follow him. Quite honestly, I have no idea what that means. But let's say it has something to do with suffering. And by extension, let's say it has something to do with fear and anxiety and death. And doing something you think is impossible, like taking up a cross, and even harder, following Jesus. Let's say that everyone has a cross to carry. But let's also agree that the size and weight of the cross are not even across the board. I get one kind of suffering. My five-year-old neighbor on the bike gets another kind of suffering. My cat gets another kind of suffering. For whatever reason, it appears that suffering isn't distributed even-handedly. Another way of saying this is that we aren't in the same boat. Have you ever heard that? Oh, we're just all in the same boat. We're not in the same boat. We might be in the same ocean, trying to make our way, but we're not in the same boat. For whatever reason, it seems that suffering isn't distributed even-handedly. Pain and suffering, to be sure, are peculiar things. I don't know where this idea comes from, if it's theological or biblical, but it's this idea that if you are good or good enough, that somehow, because of that goodness, you'll be spared pain and suffering. I've heard things like, God's grace will not put you where God's grace cannot sustain you. But what the hell does that even mean? Am I a toy for God? Am I a little car or a little thimble on God's Monopoly game board that gets moved around when God's bored? Is God experimenting with me in my life to see how much pain and suffering I can actually endure? Is there a bet in heaven somewhere going on? If so, count me out. This is not a God I care to have anything to do with. And quite honestly, there are countless stories throughout the Hebrew Scripture and New Testament where people suffer, and it's for no apparent reason. There's no letter of intent attached to our pain and suffering that outlines the benefits of enduring under the crushing weight of human existence. And I call BS on the writers, even the biblical ones, who try to contort God into some kind of small worldview where everything that happens, happens for a reason. I get it. Who doesn't want to believe that we live in a world where everything that happens, happens for some neat and tidy lesson, and it's attached to it, and we all know what it is, and we agree on what it is? In other words, we want our pain and our suffering to have some greater, ahead of time, prescribed purpose, right? Something that explains why we're going through what we're going through. But isn't that above our pay grade a bit? I've been alive for 50 years now, and I have never, not once, ever felt like I had access to things at the level of event. That is the root cause of anything or any consequence in my life. The good, the bad, the in-between. Even if I feel like I can draw a straight line from, I did this thing and that thing happened as a result. Mostly, all I've ever felt like I had any semblance of control over, however fleeting, is this thing of what we do at the level of significance. Right? This is the level where we get to participate in the experience of making meaning. And so if the question of things at the level of event is, why did this thing happen to me? Then the question of things at the level of significance is, what does it all mean? And guess what? This meaning is not prescribed. Our experiences have no inherent meaning. Which is not to say they don't have value, they simply do not have inherent meanings attached to them. No two people could look at what has happened to you or what has happened to me and perfectly agree on what that happened to us and why, is the answer. And so it begs the question to what does this mean is actually a negotiation. It's a negotiation between my past, my present, my future. It's a negotiation between who I've been, who I am right now, and what do I need to keep going forward. It's all a negotiation. I've met people who negotiate with the events of their life from a place of shame. And so the negotiation becomes kind of response to this thing that has caused me pain and suffering must be some sort of divine confirmation that I really am a horrible, terrible person. Right? Thus, this negotiated meaning is judgment. It's one of judgment and condemnation. But I've also met people whose negotiation with the things that have happened to them, the pain and suffering that they've experienced, can lead to forgiveness for themselves and kindness to themselves. This thing that happened to me that caused that pain, that caused that suffering, that wounded me deeply, I choose now to respond to it in such a way that it makes me more resilient and more compassionate and more understanding. That's a negotiation. The outcome of our life experiences are not prescribed. They do not have inherent meaning or meanings, which is not to say they don't have value. They just do not have inherent meaning. Everything is a negotiation. You will get out of those experiences what you need to get out of them. And we may think we prefer it the other way around, where everything is somehow prescribed, and we just have to be great detectives to figure out what God is really up to. If we just peel back enough layers, then we can get to the core of the meaning. It's like trying to come to the original intent of a poem, right? Like, what did the original author mean with this poem? Or what did the artist mean with this artwork? Everything is a negotiation. We like this idea of prescribed outcomes and meaning on some level because it says to us the universe isn't chaotic and the universe isn't arbitrary and the universe isn't dishing out pain and suffering indiscriminately. But as soon as we go down that path, we must also fully commit ourselves to a God who simply is punishing us to teach us lessons along the way and will keep punishing us over the same lesson until we learn it so that we can then advance to the next level of the game. Honestly, I find solace not in the thought that being a follower of Jesus means I'm somehow immune to pain and suffering. I find solace in trusting that the story of Christmas, the story of Emmanuel, the story of God with us, is a story where God has promised not to abandon us, no matter what we're going through. I can't find anywhere in Scripture where Jesus tells me being a disciple means I get out of jail card on pain and suffering. But I see ample evidence where Jesus made sure others were never alone in that pain and suffering, whether it was self-inflicted or it was the result of some invisible system, power, institution willing it upon us, Jesus is there nonetheless. And if we take a step further, not only does Jesus not promise a pain and suffering-free life, Jesus goes so far as to say that, in fact, the closer you walk to me, the closer you are in proximity to me, the more likely you will experience pain and suffering. There appears to be this direct correlation between our proximity to Jesus and our proximity to pain and suffering. This is the theology of the cross. And wouldn't that make a wonderful mailing if you were to send something out into the mail to Danville? Dear overwhelmingly rich and affluent people of Danville and the San Ramon Valley, join us for worship this Sunday where you can walk alongside Jesus and experience levels of pain and suffering you can't even begin to imagine. I mean, this place would be packed. There would not be an empty seat in the house, right? If we did truth in advertising. What a novel idea for the church to be true in its advertising. The truth of the matter is that bad things happen to good people. And good things happen to bad people because you know what? There is no such thing as good people and there is no such thing as bad people. There are only people who sometimes do good things and those same people who sometimes do bad things. And even who gets to determine what is good and what is bad is up for grabs, since we aren't sure who gets to decide what qualifies what is good and who gets to decide and qualify what is bad. All I know is that apparently Jesus was as good can get, and that didn't get him a get-out-of-pain-free card. When my mind turns to parsing the mysteries, the deeper mysteries of pain and suffering in my life, I almost always end up thinking about my role as a parent to three kids. I'm not sure why, but somewhere along the way, I bought into the idea that it is my sole purpose in life to protect and shield my children from any type of pain and suffering. Anyone else as a parent or nieces, nephews feel that way? So over the years, when one of my kids would make less than stellar decisions at school, for example, I was often inclined to say to them, "Don't worry, my perfect child. I will blame the teacher. It's the teacher's fault for you behaving the way you're behaving." Or my kid makes a less than stellar decision at home. "Don't worry, my perfect child. I'll blame your siblings. They're responsible for your behavior and attitude." You've likely heard of the helicopter style of parenting, where the parent swoops in at any sign of trouble, guarding the child against anything that could meddle with the child's self-esteem, which actually sounds pretty good, sounds pretty healthy, except when you realize that your kid never quite learns how to cope with difficult and challenging situations. And why would they? You swoop in every single time. And so those kids, not surprisingly, grow up to be adults who are always looking around for someone else, mom, dad, whoever, some authority figure to swoop in to save the day, but looks around and sadly finds there's no one there, which is devastating. I came across an equally appropriate name for a complementary style of parenting to helicopter parenting last week called the lawnmower style of parenting. Have you heard of this one? Where the parent steps in and mows down any obstacle that is placed in front of the kid. It's taken me a long time as a parent. I'm still learning this as the parent of a 21-year-old daughter, an 18-year-old daughter, and a 14-year-old son, to praise the struggle, not the outcome. Not, "Oh, you're such a good reader," but, "I'm really amazed at you continue to stick with just working through difficult words. Well done. You should be, not that I'm proud of you, you should be so proud of yourself." I've always had this saying with my kids, "Life is hard, be suspicious when it's not." I also like to remind them that everything that is fun is not necessarily important, and not everything important is necessarily fun, which is another way of saying life is hard, be suspicious when it's not. And I'm not trying to make my kids paranoid or neurotic. I just want them to be honest about how hard life can be. I'd rather them go into anything with eyes wide open on how hard life is rather than to think that life is somehow supposed to be easy, and then find out that they are devastated when they realize that it's ever rarely easy, and think that then somehow they've done something wrong to make life so difficult and to feel so horrible. I think this might just be something along the lines of what Jesus is trying to do with his disciples, especially in this story with Peter. Jesus and the disciples are passing through Caesarea Philippi. This is the home of many, many Roman gods, and most notably Pan, the half-goat, half-man god of fear, is the most prominent Roman god in Caesarea Philippi. There was this place in Caesarea Philippi called the Grotto of Pan, or the Cave of Pan, where worshipers would come and they would bring human sacrifices to the goat god. They would throw the human sacrifices into the water that would naturally flow to the back of the cave. If the sacrifice disappeared from sight, then the worshipers believed that the god Pan had accepted their sacrifice. If, however, they were to see blood in the water, then they believed that Pan had rejected their sacrifice, and they would then throw another human sacrifice in to hedge their bets. It's in this region, perhaps by the grotto itself, that Jesus decides to conduct this little focus group with his disciples. And so if I were writing my translation, the text would have read, "In the land of many Roman gods, most notably the god Pan, who accepts human sacrifice, who do you say that I am? Who do people say that I am?" And of course, the disciples, being good Hebrew rabbinical students, run through a long list of names in circulation at the time, but it's Peter who finally arrives at the right one and hits the nail on the head. "Jesus, you are Christos. You are Messiah. You are anointed one. Indeed, I am, but don't tell anyone you know this," says Jesus. But why not? Why not tell anyone? Why keep the right answer hidden? Interpretations abound. But maybe because Peter and the other disciples too have the right title, but they don't possess yet its meaning. You see, the disciples are thinking Christos, Messiah, anointed one's power can kick out the occupying Roman army once and for all. But Jesus is thinking, my exercise of power will look a lot like me dying a humiliating and excruciatingly painful death on a cross to subvert this myth of redemptive violence. I didn't come to kick out the occupying Roman army. And Jesus says to his disciples, life's hard. Be suspicious when it's not. And the disciples might have been suspicious of Jesus being nailed to a cross, executed by the state. But Jesus would have been suspicious if his public ministry didn't result in what transpired reportedly one Friday afternoon. Well, my advice to my kids, and maybe Jesus' advice to his disciples, is only partially helpful. I should actually tell my kids what Jesus told his disciples. Life's hard, be suspicious when it's not. But also, and he adds, don't be surprised to find that God is in the midst of the suffering with you. Not to keep you from going through whatever it is that you're going to go through, but to walk alongside you every step of the way, to accompany you in whatever you're going through, to walk with you through, not around, not under, not over, but through the valley of the shadow of death. And honestly, isn't that what we really want? I mean, deep down, we know that this idea that you can somehow go through this life without ever bumping up against pain and suffering, it's just a fiction. It's just a superstition. I don't know anyone who wouldn't find some solace in experiencing less pain and suffering in their lives, but I think more than anything, what we deeply and profoundly want to know are these two things. One, can I come out of the other side of whatever I'm going through, hopefully a little wiser, a little more resilient, a little more sensitive to what others are going through or what they're about to go through? And two, that no matter what they're going through or what I'm going through, none of us have to go through it alone. Isn't that all we really want? Does that track? I'm sure there are more things we could come up with, but at a minimum, to come out saying, I'm stronger than I realized, and two, I'm not alone. Give me those two things, and I have a pretty good shot at tackling whatever comes my way. It's sometimes easy to miss out by the cave of the goat god Pan, or in the middle of the wilderness of Lent, but every place is a classroom for Jesus. He's an educator at heart. When Jesus goes through what he's warned his disciples in advance he'll be going through, Jesus needs his disciples to not be fooled into thinking that Jesus' death was some horrible mistake that could have been avoided at all cost. And while I don't believe God was causing it or allowing it, that doesn't mean that God is absent from it. In fact, Jesus needs his disciples to trust that God is in it, but not as a passive spectator, that God is in it, working to actively turn Jesus' hurt flesh into a body that will last forever. That's the part that Peter misses when he tells Jesus to quit talking nonsense about suffering and death. And he also misses the part about taking up the cross and losing his life in order to find it. Jesus has pitched this vision to his disciples that challenges the conventional wisdom of the day, which was this: when you see suffering, go in the other direction. Do not do hard things. You cannot do hard things. I think we live in a world today where we have communicated to people when they bump up against something hard, clearly you shouldn't have to do hard things. Go in the other direction. It's the conventional wisdom. In the first century, it's the conventional wisdom. In the 21st century, and yet Jesus says, take up your cross, which was kind of weird, seeing as how Jesus hasn't died on one yet. So what would be the point of the message? Well, even though Jesus hasn't been nailed to a cross yet, he knew that the thought of a cross for his disciples, of which they were well acquainted, struck fear in their hearts like nothing else. Nothing like a Roman cross and hanging on it struck fear. The cross represented for them the worst thing, the absolute worst thing that could happen to a person. And you would do well to avoid one at all costs. But Jesus subverts this fear. He tells them to take up the cross. He says, there are worse things in this world than death. And living in fear was near the top of that list. If they allowed fear now, in this moment, to somehow control their lives in this pivotal and transformative moment, then they might just get to the end of their lives only to learn that they had never, ever really lived in the first place. And so he says to them, instead of surrendering your lives to fear, surrender them to God. God's voice has never promised safety, but it has always promised life. It has never, ever offered freedom from pain, but it has always offered freedom from fear. And isn't that what we also really want? We know that pain and suffering is part of being human. What we really want to know is, does it have to be so effing scary? Do I have to be afraid all the time of what's just around the corner? Do I have to be afraid all the time of what I'm about to lose? Do I have to be afraid all the time of never measuring up? Fear and fear and more fear. And I'm not talking about this kind of biological fight or flight, hardwire, evolutionary-driven fear. There's a purpose for that in our lives. I'm talking about the deeper existential fear, the deeper existential anxiety and dread of being human and what happens when I'm no more. Jesus doesn't promise us freedom from pain, but he does promise us freedom from existential fear and dread and anxiety. It doesn't mean we don't feel that kind of fear too, because we do. It just means that it does not have to define us, and it certainly doesn't add any days to our lives trying to hang on to it. If you taking up your cross and me taking up my cross is the antidote to fear, along with love, then it would be wise for us to find our crosses rather quickly, right? The good news for those of us pressed for time amid our daily routines of being important and notable in our fast-paced schedules is this: your cross will find you. You don't have to worry about scheduling time to look for it. But if you did have to go looking for it, Jesus is reasonably sure you already know where it is. To us and to the disciples before us, Jesus says, go ahead, pick up that wretched cross. Stop covering it up in your life and tripping over it, whatever it may be, and pretending it's not there right in front of you. It's there. Squat down, get a hold of it, so you can find out for yourself that there is more to life than being afraid of it, to being afraid of death. 2,000 years later, crosses today do not have much to do with standing up to the Roman government, but fear, on the other hand, is timeless. And my guess is that each of us this morning have something of which we are deathly afraid. Maybe it's the fear of admitting an addiction that is eating away at your life, the lives of those around you, or maybe it is the fear of tackling a memory that is so powerful and so poignant that it still has the power to suck the breath right out of you. Maybe it's the fear of standing up for something you believe in or telling the truth about who you are to people who are then going to in turn damn you for telling the truth about who you are. Maybe it is the fear of discovering you have an illness that no medicine can cure, or that if your child does, or your friend. Whatever it is that scares you to death, so that you start offering to do anything, if it will go away, anything at all, that's your cross. And if you leave it lying there on the floor, it'll kill you. Literally. If you turn away from it with the excuse that this should have never happened to you, you might be right. But you should also get in line and join the many before you who denied God a chance to show up in the greatest mystery of them all. That there, right there in the dark fist of your worst fear, is also a door to abundant life. And none of us can say any more than that. None of us can know any more than that. The first become the last. Want to be at the front of the table, sit at the end. Want to find your life, lose it. You want power, be vulnerable. Want to lead, serve. See that seed over there that's so small? You're never going to believe it, but it's going to be the biggest tree in the garden. The lowly will be lifted up. Those who decrease will increase. The God who is up comes down. The power to condemn is used as the power to forgive. It only doesn't make sense, any of this, right? If you think the current standards of what passes in our world as desirable is the way things should be, that's the only way. None of that stuff I just shared makes sense. If you've bought into that and accept that. But truth be told, I never thought I could go through the pain of losing anyone else to death, even a family member like a pet. It's too painful, but I've had cats and hamsters and guinea pigs, hopes and dreams, and many people that I've loved die in my arms or in front of me since that awful day. I've done at least 60 funerals in 23 years. And I'm not saying it ever gets easier to take up your crosses the more you have to take them up, or that you'd even want such a thing. I'm saying that when you reach down and you pick up your cross, it isn't nearly as scary once you get your hands on it. And no one is asking you to handle it and carry it alone. All you ever have to do is believe in God more than you believe in your fear. And who knows? In the worst of moments, you might even look up and through the window see yourself staring at a 5-year-old kid riding a bike with not a care in the world, smiling and waving at you on what feels like the worst day of your life. And that's God, too. Amen.